This recording is a production of Faith Builders. This presentation was recorded at Reach 2013, a conservative Anabaptist ministry convention hosted by Faith Builders on March 14 and 15, 2013.
My name is Gary Miller. I live in Caldwell, Idaho, southern part of the state of Idaho. And I work for Christian Aid Ministries in the SALT program primarily, which is a microfinance program working towards sustainability. I want to begin this afternoon talking a little about the possibility of creating harm when we're actually trying to help people. I think sometimes we have a struggle even in understanding that's a possibility, but it's a very real possibility. And I want to begin with that. I want to look a little at understanding our own poverty, understanding that poverty is not something that is just other people, but all of us have a little poverty in our lives. If we can understand that and grasp that, it helps us in trying to help other people. We also want to look a little at discerning the actual need, not just dealing with symptoms, but the importance of looking at actual need. And finally, look at the importance of letting people be children of God, not our children. Actually turning them over to God. Let's begin by just thinking a little about the possibility. And to illustrate this, I want to tell a true story. It happened in the mid-1800s in Panama. All of us are familiar with the story of the Panama Canal and how that was dug out. But the French were there before the Americans came trying to dig this. And as most of you know, the primary problem with the Panama Canal and the obstacle they faced was not terrain. It wasn't rocks. It wasn't all that. It was a little thing called a mosquito. But they didn't know that then. All they knew it was called malaria, and the word malaria actually means bad air. They thought that there was some bad air in the jungle, and every night that air would come in and inflict people and got them sick, and they got this malaria. And so every night they would try to shut up those buildings. They would shut all the windows and doors and try to seal the house off to keep that bad air out. Well, in the middle of this period, a lot of men were sick. There were a group of nuns called Sisters of Charity that came from France and devoted their lives to helping these men who were sick with malaria. And they tried everything. They tried sealing up the house, and they'd have a hospital, and they'd try sealing that up. But in spite of all that, the people got sicker. And they could tell that wasn't the problem, so they kept trying to find the root problem. What was the root problem of this malaria? And somebody noticed that during the day, there were ants that kept coming across the floor. And they'd watch these ants go up the hospital bed and sometimes into the bed. And they said, that's what it is. It's ants. Ants are bringing malaria. And someone else said, well, if that's the problem, I can take care of that. And so what they did is they went and got hospital pans and filled them with water. And they took every post of every bed and put it in a pan of water. And they watched. And the ants come across the floor. And they got to this pan of water and they stopped. And they said, aha, we took care of the problem. How many of you know what happens when you mix mosquitoes and water? You have more mosquitoes, don't you? So unknowingly, they were actually making it much, much worse. They were providing a breeding ground right around all four corners of that bed for these individuals. Now, think about this just for a moment as it relates to what we're talking about today. Was it impure motives that caused the problem? No, these ladies were giving their lives to help these men. It wasn't impure motives. And many times, that's not our problem either. We go to developing countries. We really want to help these folks. That's why we're there. That's why we left our home. But if we don't get the root problem correct, if we don't go for the root problem instead of dealing with symptoms, we can cause long-term harm. That's called unintended consequences. Let's look a little at this question. Why do we struggle with unintended consequences? One of the reasons we struggle with unintended consequences, and this is a major one, is we tend to equate wealth with wisdom. We tend to assume that because I'm an American, because I have a lot of money in my back pocket, because I have an American passport, I must have the answers. It's a very subconscious thing. We go into these countries and just assume that we can just fix problems and ask no questions. And when you assume you're very wise, you tend to not ask questions. And that's what we do. We go into these developing countries and we don't ask questions. But the root problem of that is we lack humility. We really think that we have the answers to all of their problems. Second, we neglect the underlying cause. We treat the symptom instead of the cause. We see a man without food, and we assume if we give him food, that'll take care of the problem. But we're not looking at the underlying cause. What is creating that lack of food? What is it? And this will take time and discernment. We'll address this a little more later on. Another problem that we don't like to talk about is sometimes we actually need the needy. We kind of like to play God. We kind of like to be fixers. We want to be known as going into this community, and it was awful when we got there, but now it's a wonderful place. We saved the people. And there's something inside of all of us that struggles with this. We really want to be saviors of the people instead of actually pointing them on to the Savior. So a while back, I wrote a book on this topic recently, and I was doing some interviews with people, and I talked to a man who's in charge of some humanitarian aid programs. And we talked about this a little bit, and I described how, in his situation, we could take care of that problem if he would simply use some different techniques. And he paused a little bit and said, yeah, but what would happen to all of our programs? Now, see, he'd lost sight of why he originally came, and everything now was simply involved in a program, and these needy people were part of what made this whole cycle go. And he'd lost track of why he originally came. Needing the needy. It's very common. Another reason we have unintended consequences is because relief becomes the default response. We immediately turn to relief. And we'll get into discerning this in just a moment. But when that happens, when we go into a developing country and we always just give relief, you're going to have unintended consequences. You're going to have problems. Let's look at some of these unintended consequences, some things that happens. When relief is the default response, one thing that happens is the receiver learns they are incapable. Every time you keep giving a man a gift, you're reminding him, I don't really believe in you. I don't think you can do it. I just don't think you can. Another, the focus shifts from their resources to ours. You know, when you arrive in a country, a developing country, all of these people that are there are depending on resources. That's why they're alive. They have soil. They have local markets. They have natural abilities. They have talents. They have all of these things going. Now, maybe they're, from your perspective, they're not working very well, but they are resources they are using. But when you come in and begin giving them things, their tendency is to move their gaze from their resources to you. And the reason they do that's real simple. All of us would do it too. Why go out and disc and plow and plant and weed and harvest if you can get it off the back of your truck? Why would you do that? And there are places in Africa today where individuals do not even plant because of that. It's much easier to wait for that aid truck to come. That's one of the consequences when relief is the default response. Another thing that happens, it creates feelings of worthlessness and shame. There's been some studies done in the last few years going out into developing countries and asking them questions about how they're getting along with poverty and how they feel about it and just trying to inquire. And they found that the words they use are different than the words we tend to use. When we talk about poverty, we use words like inadequate housing, poor water, malnutrition. They're all things. When they talk about poverty, they talk about that too, but there's something else, other words that came up. They use words like embarrassment, shame, feelings about it. How embarrassing it is for someone to keep giving me something. They're emotional words they're using. They have feelings too. They're not just statistics. They are actually individuals. They're people, and they have feelings. And when you continue to give them things, you create more of that in their lives. Another issue is the word paternalism. That's something that happens when relief becomes the default response. What is paternalism? Paternalism is just simply when you become their parents. Now, all of us grew up in a home of some kind, and I suspect that for most of us, we sit down at every meal and gave very, very little thought to where that food come from, and very little thought to where it was going to come from next meal. It was just always there. They took care of it. That was their responsibility. We didn't even think about it. It was just there. And we can do that too. When we go into a developing country and we begin to just provide things for them. Here's some more food. Here's some more clothes. Here's some more of this. Here's some more of that. We become like their parents. And consequently, the sad part is they become like children. They lose their ability to imagine, to plan, to take risks, to try things. They lose that creative ability. I was just a couple weeks ago in a Navajo reservation, and they had asked for some help there and trying to figure out how to get people back to work. I looked at these people, and it's the saddest thing to see people who at one time could exist on just about nothing out there. They were extremely resourceful people, but they've been reduced now to where they can hardly even think and imagine, simply because of a monthly check, because of someone coming along and just taking care of their needs, to where they've lost that ability now to think. And the last thing we want to look about in how do we struggle, or why do we struggle with unintended consequences, is an improper definition of poverty. I'd like for you to think for a moment in your own mind, when I say the word poverty, what do you think of? What's the first thing that comes to your mind? Maybe when you think of poverty, you think of a lack of material resources. And if that's true, if you think of poverty that way, and most of us do on some level, then the answer to that is simply to give the man material things. Or maybe it's a lack of knowledge. And if it is, if that's your definition of poverty, then the answer to poverty is simply giving them education. Or maybe it's a lack of good government and social justice. And if that's how you define poverty, then the answer to that is to fight for social justice. Or maybe just spiritual truth. When you think of poverty, you just think of a lack of the gospel. And if that's the case, then the answer to poverty is give them the gospel. But what is your definition? And also, why does the definition matter? Because you notice that each time I gave you a possibility, you also have an automatic answer to that. When you define what poverty is, you are automatically deciding what the answer to it is. So it's very, very important that you start right when you deal with poverty. What is poverty? Poverty is a lack. What is a lack? Who is lacking in this world? And we all know the story of Adam and Eve. I'm not going to go back and spend a lot of time, but I want to propose that when Adam fell in the garden and things basically fell apart on this earth, things were broken, that every individual who lives here has some poverty within them. All of us lack. I've marveled how many times we went to a place like Haiti, and we'll go out and work with the people during the day. We'll come back in the evening and maybe eat a meal and sit around and talk, and our discussion normally comes back to what we're learning from them. We're finding out that we had some poverty. We're finding out that we were rushing through the day and didn't take time for relationships, and we have poverty in our own lives. We thought we were the wealthy ones coming here, but the reality is we both have poverty. We have different kinds of poverty. And so when we go into a place like Haiti, for example, and we see inadequate housing, we think of poverty. But I wonder if we shouldn't be looking at it a little more broadly than that. What do you think of when you see a man in America who has a large house and a boat and all the stuff and doesn't have time to spend with his family? Do you think of poverty? That is poverty. But it's a different kind of poverty. And because we are so thing-oriented here in the United States and materialistic, we don't see that as poverty. But the plea that I'm making is this, that as you address that in your own life, you're going to be much more effective in working with them. I'll just say this before I move on. One of the things that I get involved in is giving teaching on finances both in the United States and in these developing countries. And the goal that I'm shooting for in both is a focus on the kingdom. But I teach almost exactly opposite material when I go to these two. Let me give you an example. When I go to, I'll use a place like Haiti again. When I go to Haiti, I'll use examples like this. Don't cut down your mango tree because you need wood today. Okay? You're going to need mangoes next year. Think about more than just today. A typical Haitian thinks about today. That's about what he thinks about. He doesn't think about long term. When I come to the United States and give finance talks, I tell people, don't toss and turn in bed because you're not sure 30 years from now how you're going to retire. That's all they're doing. They're not even living today. They're thinking about focusing down the road. We both have poverty, but it's just in different ways. Understanding our own poverty brings humility. That is foundational to development. It is so important to begin with humility. Understand when you go into a meeting with someone in a developing country, go in to learn something from that meeting, not just to tell them what to do. And you'll find that they will even receive it different from you. We will also tend to ask more questions before fixing them. You will find yourself, as you begin to address your own poverty, you'll be able to understand the need you have to learn from them. I was in a a developing country here several years ago, and I was waiting for someone. It was a busy intersection there, a lot of going on and dust flying, and I just watched everything that was going on around me, and I asked myself this question. I said, Gary, if you were dropped here right now, how long could you live here without asking one of them some questions? And I concluded I couldn't live very long, and here's why. I didn't understand their culture. I didn't understand their language. I didn't know where to get water. I didn't know where to get food. I wouldn't know how to fix the food if I did get it. I didn't know anything about them. So what makes me assume that I can come driving in a brand new Land Cruiser and step out and start telling them how to do everything? If I can't even survive there, they're doing that. As you begin to address your own lack, you're going to ask more questions. That is foundational. If you're going to cause these people to actually change, is to ask a lot of questions. Fosters mentoring and local buy-in. There's probably some of you here today could tell all kinds of stories about seeing farming equipment rusting and all this because they didn't have local buy-in. Somebody gave them a tractor, somebody gave them a greenhouse, somebody gave them all this, and they're not using it anymore. And why aren't they using it? Because it never was their idea. Some American came along and said, here's what you need, and left it and went home and told everybody how they saved the country. But this guy stuck back here with this thing and doesn't know what to do with it. There never was buy-in. There was no humility in coming along and asking questions, letting it be their idea, letting it come from them. Letting them pay for it even. Take some time to work through that with them. It's extremely important to have local buy-in. We focus on their gifts, abilities, and resources. When we understand that we don't have all the answers, then we're willing to ask questions of them. And we're going to look at what they have. And we're going to work with what they have. It's extremely important. Another thing I like to encourage people is help them down the road of continual discovery. As you help them learn how to discover and learn, after you're gone, they'll keep doing that. If you come in and just snow them with all the answers, there's no reason for them to ever learn anything because they don't think they're capable of doing that. The need for discernment. Understand that the cure can be a curse. Now, when I was first asked to give this talk, they asked me if I would talk on helping without hurting. And I asked them if I could change the title to helping without harming. And here's why. I want you to think about hurting and harming. If you're involved in development, if you're involved in going into developing countries and actually teaching them, you are going to hurt some people. But the goal is not to harm them. There's a difference between those two words. When you tell somebody no, they're going to ask you for all kinds of things. And you say no, you're going to hurt them. But your goal is to not provide long-term harm. Let me give you an example. We all go to the dentist sometimes. When you go to the dentist, you expect to get hurt, but you don't expect to get harmed. You're going there because you're wanting a blessing, but you're expecting it to hurt. And you're going to face that. Some of the worst days of my life have been telling people no. I was in a group meeting one time in one country, and it was a microloan program we were involved in, and they weren't doing very well with it, and they were just testing us to see if we were really going to stick with it or not, or just forgive the debt. One man stood up in the back, and he said, if you were really a Christian, you'd just forgive us debt because you know that we're poor, and you're from America. That was a miserable evening for me. But I knew that if I told that man, okay, let's just forget it, it was going to harm him long term. Now, I can take you back to that same village today, and he's doing very well. But he had to go through a process because of dependency. He had learned dependency from missions. The same box of food that can help somebody in one situation can be a curse to them in another. And that's what we're going to talk about discernment a little bit, the need for discernment. Money, management, and mentoring. Which one do they really need? That takes discernment. It may take a little of all three of them. Categorizing need. Now, what I want to do for a little while is spend a little time and categorize need. Now, I want you, this is very simplistic, but it's very important to get this concept in your mind that not all need is the same, and it's going to take some time to do that. Now, to do it, I want to divide need into two parts, just very simple. One's called critical need, and the other is chronic need. There's other ways to categorize it, but I want you just to think about the difference between critical need and chronic need. When we talk about critical need, we are talking about victims of disasters. We're talking about earthquakes, tsunamis, hurricanes, fires, all kinds of things that happen quick to somebody and change their life. That is critical need. It also includes the mentally handicapped, people who don't have the ability to function on their own. Or it would include the aged and physically handicapped, maybe someone who at one time could take care of themselves, but now they can't. These are critical need. Another thing, doing nothing has serious consequences. If you walk away, somebody's going to die or bleed or suffer. In other words, if you leave it today and walk away, then someone's going to be hurt by it. That's a pretty good clue you're dealing with critical need, if that's the situation. Now, what does the Bible say about this? Jesus said this, "A certain man went down from Jerusalem to Jericho and fell among thieves, which stripped him of his raiment and wounded him and departed, leaving him half dead." Now, picture that for a moment. Picture a man on the road, laying here, and he's bleeding and he's half dead. How wise would it be to walk up to that man and say, "Sir, I've got this great teaching program. Would you like to take this teaching program? Or we've got a lending program. I could offer you a loan." The man does not need any of that. He needs immediate care. This is critical need. If you walk away, he's going to die. He's already half dead. That's critical need. And the response to that is immediate relief, just giving to him, sharing with him, giving what he needs. That's what the man did. Jesus commended him for that. But, you know, a lot of our poverty in our world is not critical need. A lot of it's chronic need. Chronic need, some of the symptoms of that, some of the clues, is where poverty has been an ongoing problem. It didn't start today. In fact, you may not be able to identify when it started. It may go back generations. You're not sure when that is. When you come across that sort of a situation, it's a pretty good sign you're dealing with chronic need. It's not critical. Individuals have natural abilities. This is going to take some time, some discernment, getting to know them, building a relationship. What are their abilities? What can they do? What abilities do they have? Another clue, natural resources are available. This takes time as well. Just because there's not a Walmart in the neighborhood doesn't mean they don't have resources. We tend to walk in and look around, well, there's nothing these folks can do. It's going to take a little time. Their resources may be different than yours. But take the time to look and investigate. Do they have natural resources? Situations of learned dependency. When you come in to help these folks, is your organization the fourth one that's been in this neighborhood in the last 5 years? You're dealing with chronic need. Somebody else has already been here. So many times we have missions who have all these funds that need to go somewhere, and they're simply looking for a place to back up the truck and unload. But if they just ask a little bit, there's already been three trucks that just left. And they're creating a problem. They're creating dependency. Now, what does the Bible say about chronic need? There's actually quite a bit in the Bible. If you go back in the old law, you read something like this. "When you reap the harvest of your land, thou shalt not wholly reap the corners of thy field. Neither shalt thou gather the gleanings of thy harvest. And thou shalt not glean thy vineyard, neither shalt thou gather every grape of thy vineyard. Thou shalt leave them for the poor and the stranger. I am the Lord your God." And you'll find passages like this several times through the Old Testament. How do we know this was chronic need? The reason we know it was chronic need is they had the ability to go out and harvest. And God said how to do it. Notice what he didn't say. He didn't say, go ahead and harvest your grapes and then go out and harvest some more and put them in a box and take them to the four folks down the road. He didn't say that. He said, leave it in the field. Let them go out and harvest it. He wants the poor to go out whenever possible and work. We need to be working. All of us do. We need to be active and working. God intends for that. What is the proper response when you're dealing with chronic need? Now, remember, critical need, we said that the proper response was relief. When you have critical need, you relieve it. When you have chronic need, the proper response is opportunity. You provide opportunity for these people. Maybe it's teaching. Maybe it is a loan. Maybe they just need instruction in some way. But opportunity is the answer to chronic need. The importance of asking questions. Remember, you don't ask questions to be nice or because I told you to. You ask questions because you need to know. There's things you don't know about their culture that they can help you with. It's so important to ask questions. There's a book, in fact, that's on the list of resources called Giving Wisely. I think Jonathan Martin was the author of it. And he told a story in there that I want to share with you and just get a vision of this. It's a true story. It happened several years ago. Mexico City, the slums of Mexico City, there was a little indigenous church that started up. And they were very poor. They just had tarps and plastic, and their housing was very poor. Their church was very poor. And word of this got to the United States. There was a local church here in the United States that said, you know what, there's a church down there that's part of the body of Christ, and we should go help them. And so they all got in vans, raised money, drove down to Mexico City, and they built a church for these people, and they built a little house for the pastor. And they all worked together at it, had a good time, had a big group hug in the end, and took pictures of themselves with the whole church, and they went back to tell the church at home how wonderful it had all been, and show pictures and everything about it. They had just left the premises in these vans when the people who had helped them there totally disassembled the church. They took the church entirely down. They took all of the building materials, went over to a place where they had originally wanted the church to start with, but nobody had asked them, and built it in a way like they had wanted. That's not the worst of it. The worst of it is that in the next year, dissension broke out inside this church because there was this suspicion that the pastor somehow had got more than the rest of them from the people who had came, and 1 year later the church was gone. Didn't even exist there. But the sad part is the Americans were still telling how they'd saved these people. And our problem many times is we're not connecting with what's going on. If you don't ask questions, I'll go back to the first one again. We assume that we're wise because we have wealth. We just assume we have the answers. And we create long-term dependency and major problems when we do that. Steps to discernment. How can we know? And I want to say in the beginning, it's not always easy. You know, it's all nice on a PowerPoint to say, okay, well, it's chronic need and crisis need. That's just how it is. The reality is it's very difficult. But I made a chart here just to help in how you think through this. And I'm not claiming that this chart is going to always help you, but I want you just to think about it and get a picture in your mind. And picture each of these questions as just simply clues. Which are you dealing with? Just walk down through this. Did the situation happen suddenly? You know, was it like this one day and then not like this the next? I mean, what happened? Do they lack physical and mental ability? Will they be harmed if I do nothing? Just ponder that chart. Take it home with you and ponder it. As you deal with people out in these countries, learn to walk through that in your mind, and you won't be rushed into immediately dealing with situations that actually causes dependency. Letting them be children of God. I want to focus just a little on this. Developing their God-given gifts. I want you to think about something. Be very, very careful what you think about people in developing countries. Because whatever it is you think about them, they will tend over time to begin thinking about themselves. If you think of them as helpless and hopeless, there's nothing they can do, then it won't be very long until they will begin to think of themselves as helpless and hopeless, nothing they can do. But if you can think of them as children of God that God has put natural resources and abilities into and given them tools, if you can think of them that way, you'll deal with them in a way that teaches them to think about themselves that way. They're simply children of God, and there are resources around. They'll start to look for those resources. In fact, they'll find them better than you can because they live there. They know what is there. Start them onto a path to discovery. You know, we're great at teaching people just to fill in the blanks. But that's not the answer. You can't just go in and unload on them. They're going to have to learn how to discover for themselves. And as you work with them and build a relationship with them, you can teach them how to do that, how to actually begin to discover for themselves. Remember, we're not their saviors. We're mentors. We're coaches, but we're not actually their savior. Begin with assets. One of our challenges when we first drive into a developing country is we begin, and I'll confess I still do it to this day, I begin making a list of all the things they lack. They don't have electricity, they don't have water, their house isn't very good. And my mind just starts going down this list of things they lack. But train yourself to begin with assets. What do they have? What are the blessings they have here? What has God placed in their care? And begin with that list instead of the list of things they lack. What are the key people in their community? And one of the questions I like to ask people is, is, when was the last time you had a major crisis here? And, well, they'll talk about some storm that came through, and I'll say, well, how did you deal with it? What did you do? And if you listen, if you take the time to listen, you'll find out there's some key people in this area. There's a man over here who always knows how to get out of these situations. There's somebody here who knows how to rebuild the bridge. And as they begin to talk about that themselves, they begin to realize they are capable. I read about a man a while back who talked about this. He went into an area and began having a discussion like this. And after several hours of it, one of them said, hey, we're pretty smart, aren't we? And that's what you're trying to arrive, get them to see that God has given them abilities. The power of the local church. I just want to mention this. Don't run over the local church. In your eagerness to go in and help and give and share and show them how much you love them, work with the local church, assuming there's one there, to help empower that church and not just run over the top of it. And our goal is ultimate sustainability. One of the sentences that I like, I think it might be in the book, When Helping Hurts, is this. Don't do anything for them that they can do themselves. It's a good thing to keep in mind. Just don't do anything for somebody that they can actually do themselves. Now, let's look a little at the ultimate goal. I think it's very important to always keep the target in view. What is the ultimate goal? What are you after? I sit down with missions sometimes. Sometimes I go and provide training to staff for missions. And that's one thing I always like to ask them, what are you doing here? I mean, there's better places in the world to live. Why are you here? And it's amazing how many times it's silent. And they're not always real sure how to answer that. Why are you here? What's your long-term goal? But if you can first start with that, then every other little decision will help point toward that long-term goal. I'd like to suggest that one of those goals should be sustainable communities of vibrant believers. Work toward the day when you're not needed here. Make every decision with that in mind, that you're working toward a time when you don't have to stay here anymore. There's other places in the globe that need you. Go somewhere else. But always work toward that goal. Now, I had some questions recently about what if that doesn't happen. I'm not saying that if you go into an area where there's no believers, you're going to be there for a long time. But always have this goal. Always make that perpetual goal that that's where you're heading. Now, if you're going to do that, if you're going to actually create sustainable communities, there's a couple things that have to happen. One is you're going to have doctrinal sustainability. You're going to have individuals that have internalized the message of the gospel and know how to live it out and have leadership that can sustain that. One of the questions I like to ask missions is, if all of you drove down the lane today and left, how long would this church survive? And many times it's a pretty sad response. They might have been there 30 years, but they're not sure anything would happen in a few years. And that tells me something. That tells me they have not been letting the people lead and get involved. That has to happen. If it's going to be a long-term sustainable church, there's going to have some leadership there that feels the weight of responsibility. You can't answer all the questions all the time and expect them to become leaders in the church. The other is financially, and this is the one we don't like to talk about. But the reality is, if you're going to create sustainable communities, they're going to have to be able to provide for themselves and do more than that. Let me explain what I mean. When you end up in a developing country, why are you there? Well, you're there because you came from somewhere where they had more than they needed to survive. They actually were able to send you, or you were able to finance your way to get there. What you're after in a sustainable community is a community that can do exactly what you just have done. That means they are able to not only provide for themselves, but send out their own missionaries. If they're going to do that, you're going to have to give some thought to finance. You can't just ignore the issue of finance. In the program that I work with, the SALT program, I want to give you just a picture of what we try to do as a vision. Just imagine for a moment that you have a man here and he's making $3 a day. You arrive and that's his income. And he's just barely making it. He's just struggling to survive. Now, I'm going to suggest this man should still be giving. And that happens many times. I'm amazed sometimes at how much people can give that are only making $2 or $3 a day. But this is the focus we have. The first thing we try to do is to enrich his life, show him how to increase his earning, and work with him in developing his income. So let's say we get him up to $4. Okay? Now, the next thing we do is start working with him to even out an erratic income stream. Almost always, when you find someone who's making $3 or $4 a day, they don't get a check every day for $3 or $4. They usually sell a cow one day and have no income then for a couple months. And so they have a very erratic income stream, and that tends to be more their problem than the $3 a day, is they don't have any vehicle, any way to survive during those downtimes. So when I'm talking about saving here, I'm not talking about hoarding up for the boat down the road. I'm talking about learning how to plan and flatten out that income stream and be able to sustain themselves so they're not begging all the time. They actually have a way of providing for themselves. Now, one of the things that I usually teach is that one of the most dangerous things you can do is increase a man's wealth without increasing his wisdom. And so I view business teaching and spiritual teaching have to go together. Don't just go in and make the man wealthier. You need to be teaching him kingdom values at the same time so he understands how then to use that increased wealth. And then finally, we teach them giving. And when I speak of giving, this giving as we think of it exists on all these levels. You should always be giving. When I talk about giving, I'm talking about sending men out. I'm talking about working with them to help in the community around them so they're not begging from other areas, but teaching them to be a blessing right in their own community. Another ultimate goal, communities so inwardly connected they can have an outward focus. We've heard a lot about the strengths of the Anabaptists, and we do. We have a tremendous amount of strengths. This is one I think we need to work on, is being so inwardly connected we can afford to focus outward. We're going to have to start at home if we're going to teach it there. But do you realize how many of our congregations, how much energy is burnt up internally at each other that could be focusing out? And there's no reason, sometimes we think that the answer to internal conflict is just start a mission somewhere and then everybody will be okay. But if we can't get together and look face to face and eye to eye and work out our differences, we're going to have trouble teaching that to others and create sustainable communities. We need that teaching at home. It's by this shall all men know that you're my disciples if you have love one for another. I was in China here, been several years ago, and we got to talk about this topic a little bit. And the 18th chapter of Matthew, where Jesus said to go to your brother, they didn't know, this is a house church, some house church leaders I was working with, they didn't know that that was actually something that anyone actually did. They thought that was more of a theory. So we spent actually several hours acting it out, how you would actually, if someone had offended you, and how you would work through this process. But that is extremely essential for us as we work with these other congregations to teach them how to work out differences. Finally, in conclusion, congregations with a vision for continued church planting. Spawning new congregations that have that vision, that needs to be an ultimate goal. Something that we're after is creating actual communities that can do that. I think I'm going to stop there maybe. There's a lot of wisdom sitting right here. I'd like to hear from some of you questions, experiences, something you'd like to share, and we'll just see where that goes from here. We have 10 more minutes. Good question. I haven't had a lot of experience with that personally. We're getting ready to start some of that in Bangladesh. But some of you have more experience than I have. I'd like to hear input. When we go in with a SALT program, what we're planning on doing is going in, like with a savings group or a loan group, and providing teaching and trying to develop a church through that means by bringing people in and working with them. We're using it a lot like English teaching is being used too. It's just it's a vehicle to get in, creates frequent meetings. They come with a need. We work with them and hopefully branch beyond. Anybody else? We do that in the SALT program. In fact, we're involved in those countries. In fact, at 3:30 I have a talk where I'll hit that a little bit. But there is a lot of potential with coffee. Coffee can only be grown in that window, which means that there is potential there. And yeah, it is. There's a lot of potential with that. Yeah, thank you.
I was just wondering, are you acquainted with the Nobel Prize winner from Bangladesh? Eunice. Some of this micro business concept.
Yeah.
It's kind of interesting to hear that you're going back to Bangladesh with that concept.
Yeah, yeah. Actually, when I first started, his teaching was what got me started on the microfinance. Years ago, I'd go to Haiti with my children, and we would do a building project, and we'd get out and build these buildings, church or school, whatever it was, and the Haitians were sitting here watching us work. And I went home after the first one. I thought, something's wrong with this picture. I mean, are we actually helping these people? And so I started digging and trying to figure out what we can do to actually, when you go home, have moved them closer to sustainability. And I got a hold of his, and I decided the Muslims were doing a better job than we were, really, of microfinance. And that's what headed me down that path. Now, that's called the Grameen model that he promoted. And we use that in the loan. We have savings, too. We do that in the loan program. But the difference would be is in the teaching. We're using that model with loans. But then the frequent meetings that happen, we bring them in and teach them business and spiritual teaching. And so, it's very good, very good program. It's worked very well. Those of you who are involved in missions where you know you already are creating dependency. I mean, some of you here, I can tell it's probably where you're at. I want to give you a picture. If you have a 21-year-old boy and he's in bed every morning and you always bring him breakfast and you feed him breakfast in bed and he doesn't have to do any chores, he just lays there in bed all day. The day you stop bringing him breakfast, there's going to be a squall because he's got used to this breakfast in bed business. But understand, it never was his fault. And so we're going to have to take some tough steps to get out of dependency. It's not going to be easy. There's going to be lots of tears and lots of hollering and everything else. But if you're going to help that problem long term, you got to take the bottle away at some point. You can't keep going down that road because you are actually hurting them. You're not helping them. Okay, thank you. Lord bless you all.
This recording and many others are available through Christian Learning Resource, the campus bookstore at Faith Builders Educational Programs. Order online at www.christianlearning.org or call 877-222-4769.